Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling something lots of you have asked about, navigating the stock market.
Right.
And, well, more specifically, trying to figure out when might be the right time, you know, to make your moves.
Yeah, the timing question. It's huge.
Exactly. So we've sifted through some really fascinating material for you. The goal is to pull out the core insights.
Those aha
moments. Yeah, the things that can maybe help you make a bit more sense of it all, without getting totally bogged down in detail.
And the main source we've been digging into is Larry Williams' book, The Right Stock at the Right Time. It's from 2003.
Okay.
And it's just packed with analysis of, well, historical market behavior, what drives investors.
That psychology bit.
Totally. And some really interesting strategies he proposes for, you know, potentially improving investment outcomes.
So the mission here for you, the listener, is to get a structured understanding of these market timing ideas, these different approaches from Williams.
Exactly. Give you a clear path through his thinking based on his experience.
Okay, let's get into it. The first thing that really jumped out at me was this idea of a recurring 10-year pattern.
Yes. Williams talks quite a bit about Edson Gould's work.
Gould, right. He had that service, Findings and Forecasts.
That's the one. And this guy did some serious legwork. I mean, averaging monthly stock prices.
All the way back from 1881 to 1960.
Yeah, imagine doing that back then. No spreadsheets.
Wow. So what did he find?
Well, Williams explains that Gould basically created this kind of historical roadmap of market tendencies.
Okay.
And what's really fascinating, according to Williams, is how well this map, developed before 1960, seemed to align with major market events after 1960.
Like what?
Well, he points to the strong bull market of the 60s, then the sort of sluggish 70s, even the 1987 crash and the NASDAQ topping out in 2000. Williams suggests they all kind of followed Gould's long-term rhythm.
So the big takeaway is that historically there seem to be these, I guess, longer waves, ebbs and flows in the market.
That's the idea, a potential long-term pattern.
Now, here's where it gets really interesting for me. Within that 10-year cycle.
Right.
Williams highlights specific years that seem to pop up more often with strong gains. He talks about the phenomenal 5 years.
Yes. The fifth year of each decade.
And apparently, across the 11 decades they looked at back then,
uh-huh.
The fifth year showed an upward move every single time.
11 out of 11. It's pretty remarkable consistency, suggesting a strong historical tendency for the middle of the decade to be, well, pretty good for the market.
Now, obviously, past performance isn't a guarantee.
Of course. Always the caveat. But it's definitely a pattern worth noting in your long-term thinking.
And it wasn't just the fives, right? He mentioned others.
He did. Years ending in 8 also showed gains pretty often, like 8 out of 10 times in his data.
Okay.
But then, on the flip side, years ending in 7 and 0, they historically tended to be a bit weaker.
Hmm. So that 10-year view gives us some, like, broad strokes about potentially better or worse periods over the long haul.
Kind of a background probability, yeah.
But Williams also zooms in a bit, doesn't he? He talks about a 4-year cycle.
Yes, the 4-year phenomenon. He noticed what looked like a 4-year gap between market lows, specifically mentioning 1962, 1966, and 1970.
Just based on his own observation initially?
It seems so, yeah. But then he apparently dug into historical data, using more research charts going way back to 1900. And he felt that data supported this recurring 4-year cycle idea. It's like a shorter rhythm inside the longer 10-year one.
Like the market taking a breath every 4 years or so.
Something like that.
And similar to the 10-year pattern, are there specific years within this 4-year cycle that stand out?
He does mention one specifically, years ending in a 3, Historically, these tended to be less favorable, maybe more sluggish.
Okay, so a 3-year might be a bit tougher.
Potentially, based on that historical pattern.
Now, what happens if you, like, layer these two cycles, the 10-year and the 4-year?
Well, that's where Williams suggests the really potentially juicy long-term buying opportunities might show up.
When they align.
Exactly. Specifically, he points to years ending in a 2 that also happen to line up with that 4-year cyclical low.
Ah, okay. Like a double signal.
Right. He gives examples like 1932 and 1942, arguing they were exactly these kinds of moments, major historical buying opportunities.
It's like two different drum beats. And when they hit together, boom.
Potentially, yeah. A signal for maybe a particularly good time to look closely.
Okay. So we've got these big long-term cycles. Let's shift focus now to something shorter term Williams talks about,
the October
effect.
Ah, yes. The Mark Twain quote connection.
Right. Twain joked about October being dangerous for speculation.
So are July, January, September, April, November, May, March, June, December, August, and February. Something like that.
Hmm. Yeah, basically all of them. But ironically.
Ironically, Williams highlights that, historically speaking, October has often been a month where the stock market tends to find a bottom.
Really? Okay.
He points to a seasonal pattern, looking at the Dow Jones Industrial Average from 1970 onward, showing this tendency for rallies to often kick off after October.
So it's not necessarily about trading in October itself, but maybe being aware of potential opportunities emerging around then.
Exactly. It seems to be a time when, historically, a confluence of factors might create better buying points.
And he backs this up with some specific testing, doesn't he?
He does. He mentions a strategy test, just hypothetically buying the Dow on the last trading day of October.
Okay.
And then selling it on the last trading day of April.
The old sell in May and go away, but starting in October.
Kind of flips it, yeah. And the results, especially looking at data after some earlier work by Yale Hirsch, showed significantly higher average gains doing that.
Compared to doing the reverse. Buying in April, selling in October.
Right. The difference was pretty stark, according to Williams. He really emphasizes that the October to April folks historically did much better.
Suggesting it's maybe more than just random noise.
He argues it points to a persistent seasonal tendency.
So why? What could possibly be driving this amazing October effect, as he calls it?
Well, Williams throws out a couple of potential reasons, not definitive proof, but plausible ideas.
Okay.
One is that, you know, lots of companies release quarterly earnings around October.
Third quarter results, yeah.
And sometimes maybe those reports aren't super rosy, leading to selling pressure, maybe creating oversold conditions.
Makes sense. What else?
He also mentions a historical tendency, or perhaps observation, that the Federal Reserve might sometimes take steps to stimulate the economy around that time of year.
Interesting. So a mix of corporate news cycles and maybe monetary policy tendencies.
Possibly. And he ties in the bond market, too.
How so?
He notes that treasury bonds often tend to rally, which means interest rates are falling from late October into, say, Christmas week.
Okay.
And strength in the bond market, falling rates, can sometimes precede or support rallies in the stock market.
So it's all connected. Bond buying picks up in October. Rates fall. Maybe that helps stocks find a footing.
That seems to be the connection Williams draws, yeah.
Hmm.
It helps explain why attractive stock buying opportunities might often pop up around then.
Okay, fascinating stuff on the timing patterns. But Williams doesn't just look at calendars and charts, right?
Mm.
He stresses understanding how investors actually feel.
Absolutely. He gets deep into investor sentiment, particularly using it as a contrary indicator.
Contrary indicator, meaning you look at what most people are thinking or doing and consider doing the opposite.
That's the gist of it, yeah. When the vast majority of investors become extremely bullish, really optimistic, the contrarian view is that maybe there aren't many buyers left. Everyone who's going to buy has bought, which could set the stage for a market drop.
Okay, and conversely.
If there's widespread pessimism, extreme bearishness, it might mean most of the selling is already done. The market might be washed out, creating potential for a rally.
Going against the herd mentality.
Precisely.
Does he mention specific ways to, like, measure this sentiment?
He does. He talks about looking at surveys of investment advisors, for example.
Yeah. What do they show?
Well, he cites the Investors Intelligence Service and notes that when a really high percentage of advisors become excessively bullish,
like super optimistic,
yeah, over the top, that has often come before significant market declines.
Wow.
And the reverse, though he notes extreme bearishness among advisors was less common in the period he was writing about, could signal potential rallies.
Interesting. What about individual investors.
He discusses odd lot short sales.
Odd lots. Those are small trades, right?
Mm-hmm.
Typically retail investors.
Generally, yes. And short sales mean they're betting on prices going down.
Okay.
So if you see really high levels of these odd lot shorts happening right at market lows.
When prices are already down.
Exactly. It suggests that the public is extremely pessimistic. From a contrarian view, that might actually be a bullish signal for the market overall.
Because the little guy is often wrong at extremes.
That's a traditional interpretation William seems to follow here, yeah. And a decrease in those short sales, suggesting the public is getting more optimistic, could precede market declines.
Okay, that makes sense. Is this just about the overall market, or does it apply to individual stocks too?
Oh, definitely individual stocks as well. Williams actually describes creating his own sentiment index specifically for that.
How does that work?
Same principle, basically, gauging the bullish or bearish attitude of advisors towards a specific stock.
And using it contrarianly again.
You got it. If sentiment on, say, IBM gets extremely bullish among advisors, that might suggest IBM's price could be due for a fall.
Even if the company seems fine.
Potentially, yeah, if the optimism is just excessive. And if sentiment is extremely low, very few bulls.
Could be a buying opportunity.
Especially if the company's fundamentals still look solid, yes. It might signal the stock is oversold due to negative feelings rather than facts.
This idea of measuring and reacting against the crowd's emotion, it really adds another layer, doesn't it?
It's a big part of Williams's approach. Market moves aren't just logic. They're heavily driven by fear and greed.
Okay, let's switch gears a bit. Because William takes aim at something pretty fundamental. The classic long-term buy-and-hold strategy. He actually calls it a fallacy.
Yeah, he's quite critical of the blind buy-and-hold approach.
Why? I mean, isn't that what everyone tells you to do?
His argument is that while, yes, the market has trended up long-term, when you buy matters.
A lot.
So simply buying and holding forever isn't foolproof.
Definitely not, according to Williams. He argues you can face really significant losses if your timing is terrible, even with good stocks.
He gives examples, really.
Oh, yeah. Pretty sobering ones. He mentions a group of well-known, respected blue-chip stocks from the early 70s.
Like household names.
Absolutely. And collectively, between 1972 and 1974, he says they lost something like over 80% of their value.
80% on blue chips. Wow.
It shows that even solid companies aren't immune to massive drawdowns if you buy near a major market top.
And he also talked about the more recent stuff from his time, the dot-com era. Exactly. The new economy stocks of the late 90s, early 2000s, many were hyped, recommended by big names, and then they crash and burn spectacularly. He really hammers the danger of chasing whatever's hot.
What goes up fast?
It doesn't always stay up there.
Hmm.
He points out many high flyers eventually face huge drops or even bankruptcy. It's a reminder that market darlings can fall hard.
He even quotes Jesse Livermore, didn't he? The famous speculator.
Yeah, saying something like, poorly timed long-term investing can actually lose you more money than short-term speculation.
That's provocative.
It is. But the core message isn't don't invest long-term. It's be smarter about when you start that long-term investment.
So it comes back to timing again.
Right. He advocates focusing your big investment decisions around those historically more opportune times we talked about, rather than just always being 100% invested.
He admits perfect timing is important.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Possible though.
Oh, absolutely. Nearly impossible. But he argues that even imperfect timing, just being mindful of general conditions, can significantly impact your returns compared to just buying anytime.
So, if blind buy and hold has these risks, what does Williams suggest instead for as he puts it, potentially supercharging returns.
Well, a lot of it ties back to what we've already discussed, being strategic about when you commit capital.
Using the cycles, the seasonal stuff, the sentiment indicators.
Exactly. Aligning your decisions with those potential tailwinds. And the other key thing he stresses is consistency.
Consistency in what?
In applying whatever strategy you choose. Don't jump around constantly. Have a plan based on value or timing or both and stick to it.
Okay. Now, he had an interesting take on value investing, linking it to the new economy idea back then.
Yeah, this was around 2003, remember, right after the dot-com bubble burst. So there was a lot of talk about the new economy versus the old economy.
And he was skeptical of the new economy hype.
Very skeptical. He pointed out that similar, this time it's different, pronouncements had happened right before previous market crashes.
History repeating, or at least rhyming.
Kind of. His core argument was that the real key, the thing that always matters, whether old or new economy, is fundamental value.
And specifically?
Earnings. He puts it bluntly. As earnings go, so go the prices of stocks. It's a cornerstone of value investing.
So focus on companies that actually make money.
And ideally, make more money over time.
He had a specific way of looking for buying opportunities based on this, right?
Yes. He looked for what he called a positive divergence. Meaning a situation where the company's earnings are actually increasing, things are getting better fundamentally.
All right.
But the stock's price has been declining. The market isn't recognizing the improvement yet.
Ah, so you get into disconnect. Fundamentals up, price down.
Exactly. He argues that can be a really attractive time to buy getting an improving company essentially on sale. He used examples like Harley Davidson and others back then.
Makes intuitive sense. Are there other fundamental things he highlights?
Yeah, he also really emphasizes avoiding companies with a lot of debt.
Why is that so crucial?
Pretty simple, really. High debt makes companies much more vulnerable if interest rates go up or the economy slows down.
Because they have bigger interest payments to make.
Right. Less money left for growing the business or paying dividends. It just adds risk.
Okay. Anything else on the fundamental side?
He also suggests keeping an eye on insider activity, buying and selling by the company's own executives and directors.
The idea being they know the company best.
That's the theory. Significant insider buying could be seen as a vote of confidence in the company's future prospects. Heavy selling? Maybe less so.
Another piece of the puzzle to look at.
Definitely.
Now, going back to sentiment for a second, we talked about his index for individual stocks.
Mm-hmm.
How did he suggest actually using that index?
Again, as a contrarian tool, he gave some specific thresholds.
Like,
if his sentiment index for stock got really high, say, over 75% bullish.
Meaning advisors were overwhelmingly positive on it.
Right. He suggested that might indicate the stock is getting overbought, maybe due for a pullback, a potential sell signal, or at least a reason for caution.
And on the low end?
If the bullish reading dropped really low, like under 25%.
Lots of pessimism.
Yeah. That could signal the stock is oversold, potentially offering a buying opportunity, especially if the company's fundamentals still looked good. He mentioned JP Morgan, 3M, Merck as examples he'd watched.
So you don't just use sentiment in isolation. You combine it with fundamentals.
Ideally, yes. And he also suggested combining it with trend analysis to maybe boost confidence in the signals.
Trend analysis.
Right.
Like moving averages.
Exactly. He specifically mentions looking at an 18-week moving average.
Which smooths out the price action.
Right. So the idea would be, for example, to look for a buy signal from the sentiment index, low bullishness, and have the stock price trading above its 18-week moving average, suggesting the downtrend might be reversing.
Getting confirmation from different types of indicators.
That's the goal, trying to filter out weaker signals and focus on the potentially stronger ones.
Okay. Williams then sort of zooms back out, talking about the bigger picture, the overall challenge of investing.
Yeah. He reminds us that despite all the bumps and crashes, the market has generally trended up over the very long term.
But he circles back to value investing's historical edge, doesn't he?
He does. He mentions that Dow study again from 1937 to 1969.
The one showing low PE stocks beating high PE stocks.
Right. Significantly outperforming not just the high PE group, but the overall Dow average, too.
And he mentioned other research supporting value.
Yeah, he references James O'Shaughnessy's work, which apparently showed strong historical performance for various value metrics. Things like low price to book, low price to cash flow, low price to sales.
So different ways of measuring cheapness.
Exactly. And also high dividend yields. All these value factors historically tended to outperform over time, according to O'Shaughnessy's research that Williams cited.
It really hammers home that idea.
No.
Focusing on fundamentally solid companies at reasonable prices seems to have been a winning strategy historically.
That's definitely the takeaway. He cautions against relying only on relative strength, just buying what's gone up the most recently, because he sees that as potentially much riskier. Value is his preferred anchor.
So how does he bring all these threads together? The timing, the value, the sentiment? What's the Williams way?
It's really a blend. He tries to combine value investing principles with those seasonal timing patterns we discussed.
Okay.
While he revisits that tendency for the Dow Jones Industrials to often do well from October into the spring, and the Dow Jones Utilities often showing strength maybe from April into the October low period, kind of counter-cyclical to each other sometimes.
Interesting. So what does he propose doing with that?
He outlines a potential rotational strategy.
Thriving.
Basically, shifting your money between high-yield, lower-priced stocks in the industrials group during their favorable season, fall-winter.
Okay.
And then potentially moving into similar value-type stocks in the utilities group during their historically stronger season, spring-summer.
Like a rolling program, following the seasonal winds.
Kind of, yeah. And he presents data from 1985 to 2001 suggesting this kind of approach could have generated significantly higher average annual returns than just holding the Dow 30 index.
Wow. That's quite specific. Does he offer other timing models too?
He does. He talks about more active timing, like using the Fabian formula.
Fabian formula? What's that?
It's a method based on moving averages. He explains rules using a 39-week moving average.
Okay, a longer-term trend indicator.
Right. Comparing closing prices of your chosen fund or index against that average, and also looking at the Dow Industrials or Utilities moving average to generate buy or sell signals.
Aiming to be in during uptrends and out during downtrends.
That's the idea. Potentially capturing good returns while trying to sidestep major downturns and reduce risk. He also describes another timing method based purely on percentage moves, buying after a certain percent rise from a low, selling after a certain percent drop from a high.
So he offers multiple angles on timing, from broad seasonal to more active mechanical signals.
Yes, showing it's not just what you buy, but also having a strategy for when you buy and sell that he feels is important.
Okay, but none of this works, presumably, without something Williams calls absolutely critical.
Yes. Money management.
He calls it the keys to the kingdom. That's pretty strong.
He really believes it's that important. He argues that how you manage your money, how you control risk, is actually more crucial for building wealth long term than having the perfect stock picking or timing system.
More important than the system itself.
That's his claim. It's all about protecting your capital. Mm-hmm. Limiting how much you can lose on any single investment is paramount.
So not putting all your eggs in one basket, obviously, but also limiting the size of the basket itself.
Sort of. It's about position sizing. He touches on concepts like maybe increasing your investment size when things are going well and you have profits. Mm. And crucially, decreasing it if you start taking losses to protect what's left.
Does he give specifics on how to decide how much to risk?
He mentions there are complex formulas, like something called optimal F, for figuring out the ideal percentage of capital to risk per trade.
It's complicated.
It can be. But Williams shares his own preferred, more practical method.
Which is?
Basically, taking a fixed percentage of your total account balance.
Okay.
And dividing that by the maximum dollar amount you're willing to lose on a single trade. That calculation tells you how many shares or units you should trade.
So the risk per trade stays consistent relative to your account size.
Exactly. He suggests a range like 6% to maybe 12% of capital at risk per position for most people, stressing you absolutely have to avoid risking too much on any one idea. One bad trade shouldn't wipe you out.
That makes sense. Protect your capital to stay in the game.
That's the core message.
Okay, as we wrap up, Williams looks ahead a bit, doesn't he? Throws out some areas he saw as potential opportunities back then.
He does. He mentions the energy sector, for instance.
Why energy?
Well, thinking about consistent long-term demand and maybe past cycles of energy crises suggesting potential for future upswings.
Okay. What else?
Financial services, figuring that as wealth grows, more money needs managing, creating opportunities there.
Makes sense.
He even gets into consumer habits like catering to couch potatoes and the home entertainment trend.
Okay. Anything broader?
Yeah, he advises paying attention to commodity markets.
Yeah.
He noted they'd been in long downtrends historically, but have potential for big bull markets when supply and demand get out of whack.
Looking for those big secular shifts.
Right. And he suggests watching what the big commercial players, the producers and users of commodities are doing as a potential clue.
In transportation.
Yeah, looking for companies in that sector that really meet passenger needs efficiently and, crucially, manage their debt well. Debt comes up again.
It seems like a recurring theme for him, avoid excessive debt.
Definitely.
And he circles back finally to those timing cycles.
Yes, reminding us that those cyclical factors, the 10-year, the 4-year, can potentially signal times of broad market strength, even if sentiment isn't extremely negative or we haven't had a huge crash yet. They can be forward-looking in a way.
So it's a really comprehensive picture he paints.
It is. Larry Williams' work really pulls together historical patterns, investor psychology, value investing, seasonal tendencies, and that crucial layer of money management. It's a whole framework.
Okay, so let's try to boil this down. For you, our listener, the key insights we've explored today from Williams include, well, these fascinating historical cycles, the 10-year and 4-year ones.
Right, and that interesting seasonal pattern, the October effect.
Plus, the power of using investor sentiment as a contrary indicator thinking against the crowd.
And his critique of just blindly buying and holding without considering when you buy, highlighting the importance of timing.
Then there's the focus on value investing earnings, low debt, and combining that with the timing aspects.
And finally, that absolutely critical piece, money management and controlling your risk on every single investment.
So this deep dive really shows that while, yeah, perfect timing is probably impossible,
definitely difficult.
being aware of these historical tendencies, the mood of the market, and focusing on underlying value can be really valuable tools.
It gives you a more informed perspective, potentially helping you decide when to be more active or maybe when to be more cautious.
So here's something to maybe chew on. As you look at the market today, right now, do you see any echoes of these patterns Williams talked about?
Yeah, does current investor sentiment feel extremely bullish or bearish or somewhere in between? How does it map on to what Williams described from the past?
It just gives you a different framework, a different lens to view things through, doesn't it?
Absolutely. We definitely encourage you to dig deeper into any of these specific strategies or indicators that caught your interest today.
Think about how these ideas might fit or not fit with your own investment goals, your own comfort level with risk.
Yeah, this has been about exploring the framework Williams laid out. The real learning comes from continued research and thinking about how you might apply or not apply these concepts yourself.